Welcome to the Industrial Revolution Immigration Test podcast. This podcast will go over the study guide and the answers to the study guide, and we'll also talk about kind of the general format of the test, and then also just sort of in general, I'll tell you guys what one of the constructive response questions is going to be on the test. So let's go ahead and get started. Second Industrial Revolution, when we talk about industry, industry is manufacturing. And the Industrial Revolution took place in the United States in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And the revolution itself was the rapid growth in manufacturing that took place in the United States. So you see a lot more factories, you see a lot more production happening. The Bessemer process made the process of making steel faster and cheaper, and steel was very important to, like, this construction process, railroads, skyscraper bridges, and everyday items like nails and things like that. Improvements. So I'm going to skip the chart questions, things like that. That should be stuff that you guys talked about with your groups. Improvement that Westinghouse made to the railroads. He made air brakes. Pullman made sleeping cars, passenger cars. And both of them made rail travelers safer and faster, or safer and more comfortable. Railroads improved society. It helped shipping, helped safer travel, and just helped overall the economy. Oil was an important part of energy in the mid late 1800s, in the fact that it was originally used for kerosene for heating and lighting, and then eventually it was used for energy sources like gasoline-powered engines and things like that. Edwin Drake was important because he found out how to pump oil from the ground, which helped, you know, U.S. get more oil supplies. Edison invented the light bulb. It helped, you know, factories stay open 24/7. Obviously helped homes. A patent is a protection on an invention so that the inventor can profit off of it and not have their ideas stolen. And so it encourages, it really encourages, you know, inventors to come up with new stuff because they know that it's protected and they can profit off of it. Edison's original power plants really struggled with carrying power over long distances. And so George Westinghouse and Nikola Tesla really improved upon it so that, you know, they developed, you know, the AC system, which allowed for electricity to be carried over long distances. Problems that telegraph posed, they were only send written messages and they were very difficult to operate, so the individual user couldn't really have them. It was something where you had to go to the office to send telegraphs. Alexander Graham Bell developed the telephone to improve upon this communication issue. Transportation innovations. You have the gasoline-powered engine, which leads to the automobile, really fueled by oil. And then the Wright brothers were credited with inventing the airplane. Textbook chapter 4.1 questions. The Civil War encouraged industrial growth because it really forced the country to produce rapidly. Factories had to produce war items, food, railroads, and really, you know, it encouraged immigration even to help with this production process. Natural resources that fueled growth during this time period, you have coal, you have timber, you have oil. The workforce really grew after, during the Industrial Revolution, or due to the Industrial Revolution. There was a lot of European and Asian immigration that really provided to the workforce and the industry during this time period. Capitalism encouraged entrepreneurs because people knew that they could make it on their own and they could strike it rich, and you know, it was an opportunity to make a lot of money. What government policies encouraged free entrepreneurs? The government gave railroad owners land. They had protective tariffs against foreign products. In general, they were a very laissez-faire type of attitude with government so that they allowed the business owners to operate on their own. Railroads made the use of new technology, like whether it was air brakes or refrigerated cars. Really, and transportation itself allowed for the fast transport of raw materials to businesses to help them get their products to market. So railroads helped businesses outside of the railroad industry, and so that was very important. Industrialization changed American society. Farms became more mechanized. There were fewer farmers needed, so farmers moved to cities. People in cities didn't have to make their own products like clothing anymore because now you had stores that provided those items. In terms of the environment, industrial waste really rose dramatically, and a lot of mining destroyed the land during this time period. And you see Congress eventually try to protect that land with national parks and other types of preserved land. Big business PowerPoint: capitalism is the government system that has little to no government interference in the economy. It's really the economy is really operated by private businesses and private individuals and companies. It's really free market in the sense that, you know, the market is free from government, you know, entanglements. The government isn't, you know, setting a lot of rules and like wage controls or price controls or anything like that. And laissez-faire is just another word for kind of like hands-off. It's a French term referring to kind of hands-off and the idea that the government was, you know, allowing things to operate and taking a very hands-off attitude with businesses at the time. Entrepreneurs are just people who start their own businesses. Government, like we mentioned in that textbook question, tried to help businesses with like land grants and also protective tariffs. Corporation is a large company owned by many different people, of stockholders who, you know, really are all, you know, if you buy stock in a company, you're, you know, have a part of that corporation, and stock is just, you know, an ownership in that company. Advantages that corporations have over partnerships. Corporation advantage is that you are only really liable for the money that you put into the stock. You can't lose any more than that. And it also helps corporations expand because it's a way for them to raise money and raise funds by, you know, offering, you know, part ownership, part stock in the company. It helps them raise funds they can use for improvements and factories and manufacturing and things like that. How did panics in the late 1800s play a role in the boom and bust economy? You just had a lot of situations where, you know, people would panic in the stock market based on certain factors. They would sell their stocks, which would cause stock prices to drop rapidly, and these panics would cause busts in the economy where the economy would struggle, and then it would improve only to have another panic down the line. Vertical integration is when a company owns all the steps in the manufacturing process. Carnegie is really famous using it for his Carnegie Steel Company. And just the idea is instead of going and buying those products from other companies, the raw materials that you need and the different things that go into making your finished product, it's the idea that you own that stuff in-house. So that means it's cheaper for you to make, it's cheaper for you to produce, and then you can make more profit or cut your prices and still make the same amount of profit because it's cheaper to make your stuff rather than buying like individual, you know, parts that you need from other companies. Horizontal integration is basically buying out your competition and not having, you know, as much competition in the market, so being one of the only companies in a given field. Rockefeller's famous for using it. He used it a lot in the oil industry, and it's horizontal integration is another word for monopoly, so either one is really an interchangeable term. Monopoly, like I said, is, you know, being one of the few major companies in a given field, which means for the company, it helps that company because there's no competition, which means you can charge, you know, relatively whatever prices you want. You don't have to worry about quality as much, and so it gives an advantage to the company. Consumers-wise, you know, consumers don't really want monopolies and horizontal integration as much because competition is what drives better quality, better prices. Just think of, you know, cell phone companies. The fact that there's multiple companies out there means that, you know, those cell phone providers really need to give you a good product. They need to give you a competitive rate. Otherwise, you can go change, you know, cell phone providers. The fact that a monopoly has in the company monopolies, monopolizing, they tend to see more profit. Small companies tend to get run out of business. And consumers tend to see higher prices because, you know, there's not competition there driving prices lower. A trust has the same sort of effect of a monopoly, except that it's not buying out the competition or taking them out of business. It's when a group of companies decides to work together under a board of directors to set prices, to set wages, to set, you know, all the different things a company might decide. And so it does the same thing as a monopoly and a horizontal integration in the sense that it's eliminating the competition. It's just instead of doing it through hostile means of running people out of business, it's when companies agree to work as a trust, like they trust each other, they're working together, and they're eliminating that competition. In the late 1800s, you saw reformers start to push back against monopolies and trust, and you saw Congress pass the Sherman Antitrust Act, which tried to limit big monopolies and big trusts. But the problem is that it didn't have much of an effect in the early years because it didn't clearly define what a trust, like what a big enough monopoly or big enough trust was to break it up, and so it was really rarely enforced in the early years. Social Darwinism is survival of the fittest in the business world. It's really what entrepreneurs of the time used to justify their success, their wealth, and their company's success to the point of monopolization and big business, because they felt like if their company was superior, it deserved to survive, it deserved to be the best, and that if your company couldn't compete, then it, you know, deserved to die off, like a species of animals that, you know, might not be able to protect itself. So big businessmen were really big supporters of it because they felt like it was their reasoning for their success and their wealth, and that why it shouldn't be like broken up or regulated. Philanthropy is giving to charity. A robber baron is someone, an entrepreneur is considered to be unethical. They would lie, they would cheat, they would steal, they would treat their workers poorly, they would hoard their money, just a negative view of entrepreneurs. Captain of industry is someone that is a positive view of entrepreneurs, somebody that is smart, intelligent, works hard, treats their workers well, gives to charity, and just helps the community overall. Entrepreneur-wise, we just did the project. Carnegie had his steel company. Morgan was a banker. Vanderbilt was railroads and steamships. Rockefeller was Standard Oil. And Henry Ford was automobiles. Textbook-wise, businesses in the mid-19th century, so mid-1800s, tended to really be one run by one person or a family. They were very local and couldn't really grow more than that family could grow. So then you start to see corporations, and the advantages to corporation is that people share the ownership. You know, you don't, can never lose more than you invest in the stock. You could take more risks, and you could raise a lot of money quickly. A cartel is just when companies making the same product agree to limit their production in order to keep prices high. Like oil companies or oil producing countries now kind of form a cartel, and they agree not to put all the oil in the market in order to keep gas prices high. That's an example of a modern day cartel. In terms of how the government tried to impose regulations on big business, the Interstate Commerce Commission oversaw railroad operations. You also saw the Sherman Antitrust Act in an attempt to start to regulate businesses. Industrial Revolution, how did Industrial Revolution and its machines change the workplace? With the machinery that comes about, you start to see a rise in unskilled labor, and you start to see a situation where, you know, there's a lot of different workers who can do the job, and so ownership didn't necessarily have to, you know, care about their workers as much during that time period. You also see specialization where you see the assembly line, where having people repeat the same step or specialize in a certain step in the manufacturing process caused production to go up, and also caused a situation where it was, you know, cheaper to produce things, and so companies were making more profit off of that. A lot of factory owners really didn't see their workers as individuals. They believed in scientific management. The idea that, you know, they're just, workers are just a part of the machinery. And so this meant if workers got hurt, if they, you know, whatever reason weren't working as well, they were often fired, and there wasn't really a lot of personal relationships there. Labor union is just when a group of workers join together in a particular field. Labor unions often use collective bargaining. Collective bargaining is when you negotiate as a group. So if you remember, we did that Tootsie Roll activity in class when, like, there were a whole bunch of workers competing for a few jobs. Everybody was competing against each other, and they were driving down wages, and the owners really had the power. the labor unions tried to eliminate that through collective bargaining, that power that was there, by negotiating as one big group instead of driving wages down in competition with one another. And so, you know, that was, you know, important for workers in order to try to gain better wages and working conditions. The Knights of Labor was an example of a labor union that was around back in that time period. It was one of the first labor unions. A strike is just when workers refuse to work to try to, you know, put pressure on the owners to give them into their demands. The American Federation of Labor was a union that was around that only took skilled workers, which meant that they were able to have more negotiating power because they had, you know, the most valuable workers in a company. Haymarket Riot was a riot that occurred between the Knights of Labor members in Chicago and the police. It resulted in some deaths, and it caused the Knights of Labor to lose membership as people looked back and felt like the Knights of Labor was associated with violence. Problems that led to the Homestead strike. Henry Frick had, you know, was running Carnegie Steel Plant in Homestead. He was replacing workers with machinery, trying to drop wages, and it really involved Carnegie Steel Company. Frick responded to the strike by, you know, locking out the workers. The workers then tried to, you know, riot and take over the plant. Frick ended up sending in Pinkerton agents, which caused a violent clash and some deaths and some injuries. Eventually, though, the government stepped in and helped the Carnegie Steel Plant, and the owners ended up on top in that conflict. The Pullman strike is a strike that occurred in Chicago, or in Illinois, in the town of Pullman, where they make the passenger cars, had a company town in which they controlled the price of rent and utilities, and they also charged low wages. The workers went on strike. Even some of the other unions supported the strike by not working on Pullman cars that were, you know, on the railroads. Eventually, the government stepped in using the Sherman Antitrust Act and forced people to work on the trains that had Pullman cars because it had U.S. mail on it. And that really kind of it breaks federal law to not, you know, work, you know, not deliver the mail. And so that kind of really forced the striker's hands, and the Pullman Company came out on top. Groups that supported child labor practices would be companies, owners, because it was a source of cheap labor. factory work in the 1880s, 1890s, the very low wages. Immigrants made up a large percent of the workforce. A lot of times it was 12-hour days, six days a week. Like hot sweatshops, very dangerous, very much adhered to the clock, the hours, structured breaks. There were a lot of more people that were around that could work than there were jobs available. Industrialization led to more families in the workforce. More jobs opened up for women, whether that was working in garment work or telegraph operators or typists. But those jobs typically were low paying, and you also needed, you know, women and children to work in order to make enough money for the family. Company towns were businesses that owned houses and utilities in a given city. They would have to buy goods from the stores that were company owned. And so, it was a way for certain companies to, you know, even make more money off their workers by the fact that they were collecting rent and groceries and all kinds of other stuff from the workers in these company towns. Socialism is an economic and political system that favors the public, or in other words, the government, having control over the economy rather than private businesses. It's the opposite of laissez-faire. Wealth is distributed more equally, and a lot of Americans rejected it compared to the idea of free enterprise and private property. But you saw some labor activists and labor unions start to borrow their ideas and trying to push for reforms. In terms of the Pullman strike, the government tried to stop it, saying that it would disrupt trade and disrupt the U.S. mail that was being delivered. Major effects of the labor movement, you saw new things like contract negotiations, you saw strikes, and you saw laws that came about to kind of protect workers a little bit more. But eventually the labor union kind of starts to break up. In the early 1900s, you start to see different factions emerge where it's not just one united front. Differences between old immigrants and new immigrants. Old immigrants came from northern and western Europe. New immigrants came from southern and eastern Europe. When you're talking about old immigrants, those countries are countries like Britain, Ireland, Germany, Scandinavian countries like Sweden, Bork, Finland, Norway, Denmark. New immigrant countries were countries like Italy, Russia, Poland, Greece were examples. And really the time period wise, old immigration tended to happen. Old immigrants, there was more from those countries before 1880. After 1880, you start to see a rise in immigration coming from those new immigrant countries. Some of the reasons why immigrants were coming to the United States is the offer of jobs and economic success and opportunity. A lot of push factors were the idea that, you know, immigrants were being treated poorly in their home country, whether that was for religious reasons or ethnic reasons. Sometimes it was war, sometimes it was famine, but those are factors that caused people to want to come to the United States. Travel in steerage was very difficult for immigrants. Usually they traveled in steerage, which was the bottom part of the boat. And it was very cramped. There was a lot of sickness, disease in those areas. Two major processing centers, Angel Island in San Francisco for Asian immigrants, Ellis Island in New York for European immigrants. At those processing centers, immigrants would have to go through health exams to, you know, make sure that they weren't bringing anything disease-wise into the country. Immigrants, when they got to the United States, tended to live in cities because that's where the jobs were at. They tended to live in neighborhoods with their like people, like their ethnic groups, so that they could carry on some of their traditions and customs and speak their languages. And that's where you get like neighborhoods in like St. Louis, like the Hill, which was very heavily Italian, or Chinatown in New York, or, you know, just different like ethnic groups tended to live together in the same neighborhoods. And you see that in a lot of major cities. Living arrangements, like for immigrants, that's where the tenements were at. It was very difficult, you know, very crowded, overcrowded apartments, little air, little sanitation, and again, a place where disease was very common. Jobs immigrants typically took were unskilled, low-paying jobs because they were farmers in their home country. And so when they got to the United States, there weren't farming jobs available. So it was, those were the types of jobs they had to take in the factories because they didn't have any skills, and so it meant low pay. Benevolent societies were organizations that were out there to help immigrants, whether with medical costs or medical bills, language, English, learning English, and just in general there to help immigrants. Nativists were Americans that were against immigration, specifically new immigration. They felt like they would bring diseases and crime and poverty, and really didn't want immigrants taking American jobs. Chinese exclusion was a law passed in the 1880s that banned Chinese immigration to the United States. The Anti-Immigration League was an organization that was against immigration. They specifically targeted new immigrants. And in terms of immigration impact, it helped spur the Industrial Revolution. They provided labor, oftentimes at a cheaper cost. They often provided new ideas and innovations and inventions. And just in general, like, brought new culture and things to the United States, which we consider it like a melting pot. Some of the factors that pushed people to immigrate to the United States, farmers were losing a lot of land in their home countries, religious persecution, war. There were a lot of things that pushed people out of their home countries. Some other factors that pulled people to immigrate to the United States, the Homestead Act was a law that was passed that gave farmland land to people. That was a thing. Railroads had pretty cheap fares. You had a lot of companies like oil companies and railroad companies that recruited people to come work for them in the hopes of getting cheap labor. Americanization programs helped immigrants learn English and adopt American customs. Despite this, though, many still tended to hold on to their customs, although their children did become more Americanized. Immigrants changed America. They fueled the Industrial Revolution. They became citizens. They elected politicians. They brought new traditions to the United States. And they really helped develop new techniques and build, America's infrastructure. Rural, urban. We're talking. Oh, sorry. Yeah. What is rural? What is urban? Rural is farming areas. Urban is city areas. Urban areas were growing quite a bit during the Industrial Revolution because that's where the jobs were at. You also had a lot of immigrants, farmers, and African Americans moving to the cities during this time period. Transportation problem. You had a lot of congestion and traffic in cities that weren't meant to have that many people. So you see a push for mass transit. Mass transit are just is just public transportation, and it helps, you know, p many people travel distance, travel around the city without taking up space. Suburbs were communities outside of cities. A lot of times it was your middle class, upper class people who moved there to try to get kind of a peaceful, quiet place to live where they could own homes instead of rent. City parks started popping up to give people an escape, like a green space to escape in the cities that were now more and more skyscrapers and everything that went along with that. Philanthropists helped build museums and libraries in cities to help education. Department stores were just these big buildings that had all kinds of you know, products that people could buy, and it was like kind of a place so that people could have one-stop shopping in the cities. Just draw a picture of tenements. You know, I know that is one you're going to discuss. We didn't really go over, and you know, depending on what classroom, we might not have gone over that as much. But Jacob Riis wrote a book and had pictures in a book called How the Other Half Lives that depicted what life was like in the tenements, and it, you know, showed people that it wasn't very good. It was, you know, a very difficult place to live. Problems occurred in cities, tenements, overcrowded houses, pollution, sanitation issues. You also didn't have full-time police force and fire departments in a lot of cities until the late 1800s. Settlement houses were organizations in cities that provided recreation, education, and social activities to people who lived in the cities. Hull House is an example of that. It was a settlement house in Chicago opened by Jane Addams. And again, it provided even things like a kindergarten to kids. Mass culture is culture that is leisure activities that are shared by many people. So instead of doing it on your own, it's like we're places where a lot of people would go, whether it's a sporting event like a baseball game or the circus or the amusement park or World's Fair. 1904, St. Louis hosts the World's Fair. You know, those are all types of things that people were doing in mass and together for leisure activities. Linotype was a cheaper way to print material, and it led to cheaper newspapers and magazines and things like that that helped spread new cultures and things like that because people could afford to get magazines. Advantages that cities offer was jobs and also better opportunities for women in cities. There was an increase in rural to urban immigration in this time period. It was, again, jobs. And it was difficult for farmers because now they had to be on a rigid schedule, like a clock, which they weren't on before. Tenements were just the overcrowded apartments. There weren't really any building codes, and so there were a lot of people, and like landlords are trying to, you know, fit as many people in there as possible, and so that was like a big part of that time period. Jacob Riis had How the Other Half Lives about life in the tenements, had pictures and writings about life in the tenements. Water and sanitation posed a lot of risk in the 1800s because there was a lot of sickness and diseases that were spread through poor sanitation and water, so you had a lot of epidemics that occurred. Fire crime and other issues that happened in cities because there were so many people within an area together. You saw a rise in crime, you saw a rise in fires. Also, you had a lot of volunteer departments that weren't full time, and so it was hard to, like, you know, keep that together and, you know, enforce stuff. Conspicuous consumerism is people really wanting the newest product on the market, and so people wanting to buy new stuff. And a lot of advertising attracted new customers by offering money back guarantees and free shipping and things like that. Standard living, the rich became richer during this time period. The middle class kind of tried to imitate that and, you know, live up to that expectation. And really the poor kind of stayed poor during this time period. New forms of entertainment, we talked about it in the PowerPoint-wise. You know, you have the circus, you have mass culture, like sporting events become a new form of entertainment, and their entertainment, the circus, things like that. All right, for the test itself, the format of the test, you're going to see about, give or take, 30 multiple choice questions. You're going to see maybe 5 to 10 short answer questions. Maybe, that could change a little bit. And those are just questions like you've seen on the quizzes, like where they're kind of one-word type answers. And then there will be some constructive response. Constructive response are going to be longer response type questions, longer essay type questions where you're writing a paragraph or, two or more extended writings in there. And I will tell you that one of the questions that will be one of the extended responses is, how did the Industrial Revolution change daily lives for Americans? Would you argue it had more positive or negative effects? So that's going to be one question that you can see. If you kind of want to prepare for that, you can know ahead of time what you might write on that question. Otherwise, if you have any questions, you can stop by and ask. And good luck.